Welcome back to the Deep Dive, where we take on vast, complex subjects, providing you with the shortcuts to becoming thoroughly well-informed. Today, we are undertaking a massive mission, a deep dive into the United States Navy, the USN. We are looking at a stack of sources detailing its, well, its sometimes surprising history, its intricate global structure, and the colossal, unmatched scale of its power projection around the world.
You know, it's impossible to discuss U.S. global influence, trade routes, or international security without starting right here.
Yeah.
The USN isn't just a military service. It's actually designated as the Navy of the United States right there in the Constitution.
Huh.
And the sources detailing is modern scale. They usually generate that true aha moment when you see the numbers laid out.
That's really the only way to describe it, because when we talk about the size of this force, we're not just talking about a major military branch. We're talking about a unique maritime superpower. To grasp its functional dominance, I think we have to start with its sheer weight.
Exactly. The key measure here is displacement. The metric ton weight of water displaced by all the ships. The USN is the world's most powerful navy by far, clocking in at 4.5 million tons in 2021.
4.5 million.
Yeah. And that single statistic, the collective mass of the U.S. Navy, is greater than the combined displacement of the next several global navies. It just speaks volumes about the sheer volume of material deployed globally.
And the most potent, most visible representation of that overwhelming physical scale has to be the aircraft carrier fleet.
Oh, absolutely.
We're looking at the largest fleet of nuclear-powered aircraft carriers in the world.
Yeah.
11 active carriers, which includes the 10 workhorse Nimitz-class vessels, and the newest, the Gerald R. Ford class, which is just beginning its rotation.
And that number is just the beginning.
Right.
You got one carrier undergoing trials, two more under construction, and six more planned as of the 2024 updates.
That capacity for projecting air power across any ocean, anytime, it's functionally unprecedented.
It is. These aren't just large ships. They are mobile, self-contained, sovereign air bases capable of conducting sustained combat operations thousands of miles from U.S. soil.
And in terms of sheer manpower, the USN is the third largest U.S. military service branch. Our sources note the current roster includes approximately 344,600 active duty personnel.
And an additional 57,500 reserve personnel, according to the 2025 figures.
And those highly trained people are operating an astounding amount of equipment.
Yeah, the latest data we have from 2018 and 2019 puts the total ship count at 480 vessels, of which about 300 are classified as deployable battle force ships, plus over 2,600 operational aircraft. It truly is a global three-dimensional military enterprise.
Which means the purpose behind this immense capability needs to be perfectly clear. What is the mission statement guiding this force?
So the USN's official mission statement defines its purpose.
Oh.
To recruit, train, equip, and organize to deliver combat-ready naval forces to win conflicts and wars while maintaining security and deterrence through the crucial concept of sustained forward presence.
That specific phrase, sustained forward presence, that feels like the operational differentiator for the Navy.
It is.
It means they aren't waiting at home for a crisis to emerge. They are consistently deployed in the Pacific, the Atlantic, the Mediterranean, shaping the global security environment just by being there.
Absolutely. And that sustained presence enables the Navy's five enduring functions, which define its strategic priorities. First, you have sea control, which is dominating a maritime space and denying its use to an adversary.
Okay.
Second, power projection, so delivering force from sea to land. Third, deterrence, which is discouraging aggression through visible, overwhelming capability.
Right, just by showing up.
Exactly. Fourth is maritime security, which includes things like counter-piracy and counter-smuggling operations. And finally, sea lift, which is moving vast amounts of military material and supplies globally.
The sources also detail the Navy's three specific primary responsibilities outlined by statute: the preparation of naval forces for war, the maintenance of naval aviation, including land-based aviation, air transport, and air weapons, and the development of all necessary equipment, tactics, and organization.
It speaks to a comprehensive, all-encompassing mandate, doesn't it?
Yeah.
They don't just sail ships. They manage everything from developing the next generation of fighter jets to defining the tactical doctrine for deep-sea anti-submarine warfare.
Okay, so let's unpack this. If the USN's current role is maintaining global order through overwhelming force, how did this massive global force develop from its highly precarious beginnings? And most critically, how is it organized today to manage a mission that requires continuous multi-ocean global reach?
A great question. Let's jump into the history. The very origins of the U.S. Navy are deeply rooted in the colonial seafaring tradition of the North American coast. You had expert sailors and builders long before the nation even existed.
And the actual founding date we recognize is October 13, 1775. That's when the Continental Congress authorized the purchase of two armed vessels, officially kicking off the Continental Navy during the Revolutionary War.
And, you know, it's interesting that Congress was highly divided on this. Many felt that challenging the British Royal Navy, the dominant sea power on Earth, was a fool's errand.
Right, a suicide mission.
They believed any money spent on a navy would be better spent on the army.
But Commander-in-Chief George Washington, he didn't really wait for permission or consensus. He essentially created a precursor navy himself, commissioning the schooner USS Hannah to begin interdicting British merchant ships.
And that proved the strategic concept was viable and lucrative. We have the quote from Washington himself articulating the existential necessity of sea force. Without a decisive naval force, we can do nothing definitive, and with it, everything honorable and glorious.
Those words should have been the final word on the matter, but the young nation struggled with funding.
Immensely. Despite successfully raiding British ships and achieving some mixed victories, the Continental Navy faced huge losses and was barely functional by the end of the war.
And here is the truly fascinating, almost unbelievable strategic twist, the Great Lapse. After securing independence, Congress, facing massive debt and prioritizing other needs, effectively disbanded the entire Continental Navy by August 1785.
They sold off their last ship, the Alliance.
The last one. And the nation was just left without a standing military sea force.
Which really raises an important question. What was the political calculation there? Why would they so easily discard a force that Washington himself said was essential?
It seems like it was primarily economic, fueled by this dangerous sense of isolationism. The prevailing sentiment was that the Atlantic Ocean provided sufficient protection.
Right, the big moat theory.
Exactly.
Yep.
And maintaining an expensive standing navy in peacetime was a luxury the debt-ridden nation simply couldn't afford. They believed they could rely on diplomacy or the good graces of European allies.
And that political calculation proved disastrously wrong within a decade.
Immediately.
That vulnerability immediately exposed U.S. merchant ships traveling in the Mediterranean and Atlantic to severe attacks by the Barbary pirates, specifically those operating from Algiers.
And thousands of American sailors were captured and held for ransom. This wasn't just a security risk, it was a devastating economic assault on American trade.
This was the true catalyst for the Navy's reestablishment. The ransoms demanded by the pirates were far greater than the cost of six frigates.
So it became an economic necessity.
It did. The direct response was the Naval Act of 1794, which finally created a permanent standing Navy. It was an admission that sea power was vital to economic survival.
And that act immediately led to the construction of six heavy frigates. The first three commissioned in October 1797 were the USS United States, the USS Constellation, and of course the now legendary USS Constitution.
And we really credit John Adams with cementing this permanent necessity. He's often called the father of the American Navy for his strong, unwavering posture on maintaining this force.
The new force was immediately tested, wasn't it?
Right away. First, the undeclared quasi-war with France from 1798 to 99, and then the decisive First Barbary War from 1801 to 1805. These conflicts showed the Navy could project force thousands of miles away, successfully defending U.S. ships. So, the War of 1812 revealed the continued gap between U.S. and European naval power.
It did. While the USN achieved spectacular individual ship victories and secured crucial operational success, like the Battle of Lake Erie.
It was huge.
It was. But ultimately, the size difference meant the U.S. Navy could not prevent the massive British effort to blockade its ports and land troops. It was a serious learning experience about scale.
They kept adapting, though. The Mexican-American War in the 1840s allowed the Navy to demonstrate its logistical and large-scale force projection capabilities.
And this is where they successfully executed the U.S. military's first large-scale amphibious joint operation, landing 12,000 Army troops with all their equipment at Veracruz in one single coordinated day.
In one day? That's incredible.
It set the standard for amphibious operations for the next century. And the Navy became an instrument of foreign policy beyond just warfare. In 1854, Commodore Matthew C. Perry used naval power and diplomacy to force the opening of isolationist Japan.
Right, establishing the U.S. as a critical player in the Pacific.
Then came the Civil War, where the Union Navy's advantage was truly distinct. They enforced the Anaconda Plan, a devastating blockade on all major Confederate ports, strangling the South's economy.
And their control over the inland rivers, the Brown Water Navy, made internal movement and supply nearly impossible for the Confederacy.
This conflict also marked a revolutionary moment in naval technology, the first combat involving ironclads.
The famous clash between the turreted USS Monitor and the converted CSS Virginia in 1862. It just signaled the death knell of the wooden warship era.
But here's where we see that dangerous cycle repeat itself. Once the Civil War concluded, the fleet was again neglected for nearly two decades.
The focus shifted away from the sea, and the aging, mostly wooden fleet became technologically obsolete compared to rising European powers.
This neglect eventually forced a dramatic turnaround, though.
It did. Modernization began in the 1880s, driven by naval strategists like Alfred Thayer Mahan. This new steel navy spurred the American steel industry and led to the building of the first purpose-built steel-hulled warships.
And that modernization paid dividends pretty quickly. The decisive victory over the outdated Spanish Navy in 1898 brought immense global respect for American technical quality and ambition.
Which really set the stage for President Theodore Roosevelt to cement that global arrival.
The Great White Fleet of 1907 was Roosevelt's masterstroke.
It really was.
He ordered a 14-month circumnavigation of the world, sending 16 battleships and support vessels to demonstrate the Navy's blue water capability. This wasn't just a military exercise. It was global diplomacy and engineering confidence wrapped into one very visible package.
World War I saw the Navy focusing heavily on protection, logistics, and anti-submarine operations. They were critical in safely shipping the American Expeditionary Force troops and supplies across the U-boat-infested Atlantic.
And they played a major role in laying the massive North Sea mine barrage to counter German submarine activity.
Then after WWI, the world entered an age of strategic disorientation and calls for peace. Naval construction faced severe limitations imposed by the Washington Naval Conference of 1921-22.
Right, the treaty that tried to cap the size and number of capital ships for all the major global navies.
Exactly.
But this restriction actually forced critical innovation, didn't it?
It did. The Navy, constrained by the treaty limits, found a loophole. Instead of scrapping partially built battle cruisers that were canceled, they converted those massive available hulls into the first significant aircraft carriers, USS Saratoga and USS Lexington.
So it was an accidental strategic pivot that laid the foundation for the next great power shift.
Completely accidental. And at the same time, they were developing their strategy for the coming Storm War Plan Orange, which was a theoretical plan for victory against Japan in the Pacific, tragically anticipating the war that arrived 20 years later.
World War II was the crucible. Despite the devastating surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, the U.S. Navy played the central, defining role in defeating Imperial Japan, executing the necessary island-hopping campaign across the Pacific.
And the monumental shift to the war was undeniable. Aircraft carriers and their planes completely replaced battleships as the decisive weapon on the seas.
Battles like Midway, the Coral Sea, Leyte Gulf, they weren't won by big guns.
No, they were won by the reach of naval aviation. The doctrine changed forever. Reach became more important than armor.
The scale of growth during that period is still staggering. By 1943, the U.S. Navy was larger than the combined fleets of every other combatant nation.
Combined.
By 1945, the U.S. operated 6,768 ships. That is a logistical feat unlikely to ever be repeated.
Post-WWII, the Cold War redefined naval strategy yet again. The focus shifted to continuous technological advancement, permanent forward deployment, and the establishment of the self-contained carrier battle group concept.
And crucially, the Navy became integral to strategic nuclear deterrence through the introduction of ballistic missile submarines, the SSBMs.
Right, guaranteeing the U.S. maintained a robust, survivable second strike capability. This naval pillar was vital in conflicts from Korea and Vietnam to the critical Cuban Missile Crisis.
As the Cold War concluded, the focus shifted from massive global conflict to regional stability and special operations, the war on terror operations dominating the 21st century.
And the modern strategic document, A Cooperative Strategy for 21st Century Sea Power, codified this change in 2007. Developed with the Marine Corps and the Coast Guard, it made a key philosophical shift.
Which was?
Elevating the prevention of war to the same strategic level as the conduct of war.
And the rationale for this preventative posture. The strategists recognized that the entire global economic system relies on secure sea lanes.
Exactly. Any regional disruption, whether from piracy, terrorism, or instability, adversely impacts the U.S. economy.
Therefore, the Navy views itself as the principal means through which the U.S. enforces and maintains that international global order, not just defensively, but proactively, through that sustained forward presence.
Right.
This brings us to the present-day dilemma regarding fleet size. In the early 2010s, the goal was 313 combat ships. By 2016, that plan called for 350 ships.
And Congress, via the 2018 NDAA, mandated expanding the fleet to 355 ships as soon as practicable.
But the reality is that the active battle force, as of 2022, stands at 296 ships.
And more tellingly, the Chief of Naval Operations himself has stated that, given global commitments, the Navy actually needs a fleet of over 500 ships to execute its mandate effectively.
Wow, that is a staggering operational gap. 500 needed, 296 active.
It is.
And strategically, the U.S. has executed the major pivot to East Asia, meaning 60% of the total fleet was slated to be deployed to the Pacific by 2020. This underscores how geographic requirements directly influence the required size and capability of the fleet.
It truly sets the stage for the rest of our discussion. How does this enormous, historically adaptive force manage the organizational complexity required to operate 300-plus battle force ships globally? Especially when they feel they need 500.
Let's pivot now to the organization and the people who make it run. So the USN is part of a complex hierarchy, starting with civilian oversight. It belongs to the Department of the Navy, which is led by the Civilian Secretary of the Navy, the SECNA.
And beneath the SECNAV is the uniformed leadership, headed by the Chief of Naval Operations, the CNO. This is the most senior Navy officer, a four-star admiral. The CNO reports directly to the SECNA and is responsible for organizing, recruiting, training, and equipping the Navy.
Importantly, the CNO is also a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. What's the distinction in that role?
It's purely advisory. So while the CNO manages the internal functioning of the Navy, the Joint Chiefs role involves advising the President and the Secretary of Defense on military matters across all branches.
So operational control is different.
Right. The actual operational control of forces is delegated from the President through the Secretary of Defense to the commanders of the Unified Combatant Commands, those geographical and functional commands that manage global operations.
And the operational teeth of the Navy are the numbered fleets. These are the forces we actually see deploying around the world.
That's right. The Navy maintains 7 active numbered fleets. The first 6 are geographically focused, covering specific areas of responsibility, or AORs. The 10th fleet is different. It handles cyber command and intelligence operations.
Okay, let's talk about those geographic fleets. Where are they and what are they doing?
Well, the 3rd fleet covers the Eastern Pacific, largely operating out of San Diego. The 7th fleet is the largest forward deployed fleet based in Yokosuka, Japan, covering the Western Pacific and Indian Ocean.
The tip of the spear in Asia.
Exactly. The 5th fleet, headquartered in Bahrain, is responsible for security in the Persian Gulf and Arabian Sea, a critical, high-tension region.
And we saw a significant recent change with the 2nd fleet.
A very strategic move. The 2nd fleet, headquartered in Norfolk, Virginia, was reestablished in 2018. It focuses specifically on the East Coast and the North Atlantic.
And this was a direct response to Russia.
A direct, palpable response to increase naval activity and perceived threats from Russia in the North Atlantic and Arctic. It underscores the shift back toward great power competition.
We also have the 4th Fleet, reactivated in 2008, which covers Central and South America. So they truly have an ocean-spanning structure.
And supporting this global operational reach is the enormous shore establishment. This is the network of land facilities bases, training centers, repair depots, designed entirely to enable and support the deployable fleet.
This includes crucial commands like the Naval Education and Training Command, the Office of Naval Intelligence, and of course the Naval Academy at Annapolis.
Mm-hmm.
Let's focus on the scale of these support facilities. On the eastern U.S., the Hampton Roads, Virginia area is the 2nd largest concentration of U.S. military installations anywhere.
It's the core home port of the Atlantic Fleet, and you have key specialty training centers, often in surprising places. Charleston, South Carolina is home to the Naval Nuclear Power Training Command.
That's where the crews for our nuclear carriers and submarines are trained.
That's it. And every enlisted sailor begins their career at NS Great Lakes, Illinois, which hosts the Navy's only enlisted boot camp.
Moving west, the sheer acreage of some of these installations is just mind-boggling. Naval Air Weapons Station China Lake in California is the largest complex in terms of size, covering 1.1 million acres.
That is massive. And to put that land holding into perspective, China Lake size relates directly to its requirement as a remote, safe location for large-scale explosive testing and weapons development.
You need a big buffer zone for that.
You really do.
The main operational hub for the Pacific Fleet remains Naval Base San Diego, though the official headquarters is Pearl Harbor. And for those interested in special operations, Naval Amphibious Base Coronado is the essential training center for the West Coast SEAL teams.
Globally, that forward presence demands huge overseas footprints. The largest overseas base is Fleet Activities, Yokosuka, Japan. This base homeports the largest forward-deployed fleet, centralizing operations in the Western Pacific.
And in Europe, NSA Naples, Italy, serves as the home port for the 6th Fleet. In the Middle East, NSA Bahrain is the headquarters for the 5th Fleet. And finally, Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, which is the oldest overseas facility the Navy maintains.
And that organizational complexity is managed by the Navy, but they have these unique formalized relationships with two other armed services.
Right. The first is the U.S. Marine Corps. They are a co-equal sister service under the Department of the Navy, a relationship established way back in 1834. It's a fundamental symbiotic relationship.
The Navy provides essential medical and religious support to Marine units. This is critical. Every Marine unit relies on Navy personnel, specifically doctors, nurses, medical technicians known as corpsmen, and chaplains.
So the corpsmen are actually Navy sailors attached to Marine units.
They are. They serve as the frontline medical personnel. And operationally, the Marines are the amphibious striking force, relying on Navy amphibious assault ships and transport docks to get them to the fight.
It's an integrated ecosystem.
It is. The second unique relationship is with the U.S. Coast Guard. Most of the time, the Coast Guard operates under the Department of Homeland Security, focusing on law enforcement and rescue.
But in times of war, they can operate as a service within the Navy.
Correct. And we see this cooperation today through law enforcement detachments, or LEDETs. These are specialized Coast Guard teams that deploy to Navy vessels, specifically to perform arrests and law enforcement duties during boarding and interdiction missions.
So they're blending the legal capabilities of the Coast Guard with the global reach of the Navy.
Precisely. Now, let's look at the personnel structure that supports all of this, the actual sailors. The Navy divides its personnel into distinct communities, starting with the enlisted ranks.
E4 through E6 are petty officers, the non-commissioned officers, or NCOs. They are the technical experts and first-line supervisors.
But the chief petty officer ranks, E7 to E9, are famously a community unto themselves.
Right. This is a deep cultural difference in the Navy.
It is. E7, E8, and E9 chief, senior chief, and master chief petty officer are considered a separate, highly experienced community. They often have separate designated chief's messes where they eat, socialize, and conduct their mentorship.
And they serve as the critical technical and experiential backbone of any ship or unit.
They do. And within that leadership structure, we have the command master chiefs, the CMCs.
What is their specific authority?
The CMC is the senior most enlisted advisor to the commanding officer. They serve as the liaison, advising the captain on all matters pertaining to the health, welfare, morale, and training of the enlisted personnel, their insignia.
Denotes their seniority.
Right. An inverted five-point star, which is silver for command-level positions, but gold for fleet or force-level responsibilities.
Given that immense personnel count over 344,000, what is the Navy doing to address the current retention and recruitment crisis that we hear so much about?
That's a critical point. The Navy is struggling to hit its recruitment targets, particularly for highly technical roles like nuclear operators, which require intense training and commitment.
So what's the strategy?
It involves substantial reenlistment bonuses, especially for those with hard-to-replace warfare qualifications. They're also streamlining training pipelines and increasing quality of life incentives. Things like limiting certain types of rotational deployments to boost retention. It's a constant battle.
Then we have the specialized warrant officers. These are the technical experts who usually don't command, but rather fix and direct.
Correct. Warrant officers are technical specialists who lead specific critical activities like electronics maintenance or ordnance disposal. They're accessed mostly from the highly experienced chief petty officer ranks, requiring a minimum of 14 years in service.
It's a way to retain deep, practical expertise.
It is, without forcing those personnel into the administrative pressures of the traditional officer career path.
And finally, the officers are divided into line officers and staff corps officers.
Line officers are the commanders, pilots, surface warfare officers, and some Marine commanders who wear an embroidered gold star above their rank insignia. Staff corps officers, conversely, are the specialized support personnel. Doctors, supply officers, chaplains, and lawyers.
The JAGs.
Right. They wear specialty designator insignias instead of the star, visually separating the operational command track from the specialized support track.
And it all culminates in the Warfare Qualification, or PQS.
This qualification is the ultimate validation of expertise. It denotes a journeyman level of capability in specific fields, like surface warfare officer or submarine warfare.
And achieving these is marked by distinctive U.S. Navy badges and insignia, like the dolphins for submariners, worn proudly on the uniform.
This focus on demonstrable, verifiable standards is crucial for ensuring the readiness of every single deployable unit.
The complexity of the organization is staggering, but it's only matched by the complexity of the equipment. Let's shift our focus now to the hardware. The world's most sophisticated ships, aircraft, and weapon systems.
When discussing the fleet, we should start with naming conventions. Any commissioned ship is prefixed with USS, designating United States ship.
And a core defining technological feature of the entire fleet is its commitment to nuclear power. Our sources confirm that all active U.S. aircraft carriers and submarines are nuclear powered,
which gives them effectively unlimited range and endurance. They only need to pull into port for provisions for the crew, not for fuel.
Let's begin with the capital ships, the aircraft carriers, the CVNs. These vessels are the largest, most expensive, and most protected assets in the fleet.
They're mobile air bases. A single Ford or Nimitz-class carrier can house up to 5,000 personnel.
It's a small city.
It really is a small city floating on the ocean, and it can carry up to 90 aircraft.
But the carrier never sails alone. It is the core of a carrier strike group, a CSG. This isn't just a collection of ships, is it?
No, it's an integrated, self-defending package designed to operate independently anywhere in the world. The CSG is typically protected by 3 or 4 Aegis-equipped cruisers and destroyers, along with 1 or 2 fast-attack submarines.
So it's a bubble of protection.
It is. A formation that ensures protection from air, missile, sea, and undersea threats, while also providing the group with immense collective strike capabilities.
Beyond the carriers, the Navy defines its tower projection through its amphibious warfare ships.
These are the vehicles of force focused on delivering military capability onto land, primarily supporting the U.S. Marine Corps.
The heavy hitters are the amphibious assault ships, the WASP and America classes. They look like small aircraft carriers themselves.
They do. And crucially, they are capable of VSTOL, STOVL, VTL, and tiltrotor operations.
We need to unpack that alphabet soup of vertical movement. What do those acronyms mean for the listener?
That's fair. So VSTOL and VTL refer to aircraft that can go straight up and down like helicopters. But STOVL, short takeoff vertical landing, is critical because it describes the capability of the F-35B Lightning II.
A marine fighter jet.
Right. It takes off with a short run but can land vertically. This capability allows the amphibious assault ships to deliver, command, and support an entire 2,200-strong Marine Expeditionary Unit.
Then you have the support vessels, like the amphibious transport docks.
The newer San Antonio classes are specifically designed to operate all three elements of the Marines' mobility triad. The new expeditionary fighting vehicles, the crucial V-22 Osprey tiltrotor aircraft, and the massive high-speed landing craft air cushions, the Elsa Gaze.
These ships are the vital bridge between the sea and the shore.
Absolutely. The Navy operates 32 active vessels across all amphibious warfare categories, which really illustrates the commitment to projecting power across the globe's littoral regions.
Now let's move to the backbone of the defensive fleet, the surface combatants and the revolutionary technology that defines them, Aegis.
Aegis is the foundation of modern naval defense. Cruisers, specifically the Ticonderoga class, were developed in the Cold War era specifically to counter the emerging threat of Soviet anti-ship missiles. Their key feature is the Aegis combat system, coordinated with the massive ANSPY-1 phased array radar.
All right, so explain how that radar system works and why it was such a technological leap forward.
Well, older radar systems required a dish to physically rotate, meaning there were momentary blind spots or time lags. The ANSPY-1, however, uses a phased array, thousands of small radar antennae, working in concert across 4 flat surfaces built into the superstructure of the ship.
So no moving parts.
No moving parts. This allows the system to instantly and simultaneously track hundreds of aircraft and missiles, coordinate multiple intercepts, and maintain constant situational awareness. It was a genuine game changer.
And with the later installation of vertical launch systems on the cruisers, they gained immense offensive power.
Yes. The VLSLs can carry a milk of defensive standard missiles and offensive Tomahawk missiles, providing long-range land and sea strike capability. This transformed the cruisers from just fleet defense platforms into multi-role offensive assets.
The destroyers, primarily the workhorse Arleigh Burke class, are the high-volume, multi-mission ships.
They are the fleet's true utility players, also focused on strike and fleet defense using Aegis. But they specialize deeply in anti-submarine warfare, or ASW. They utilize VLA rockets and sophisticated sonar arrays combined with MPS MK3rd Seahawk helicopters, which hunt subs with dipping sonar and torpedoes.
And there are 75 of them currently active.
That's right.
Now, we retired our last traditional frigate class in late 2015. Their intended replacement was the littoral combat ship, the LCS. This has been a major story of strategic ambition colliding with operational reality.
It's a textbook example of procurement challenges. The LCS concept was highly ambitious. Small, fast, modular vessels designed for nearshore combat. The idea was they could swap out mission packages for different threats.
But the sources suggest the LCS largely failed to meet expectations.
Correct. The LCS suffered from massive cost overruns, speed being prioritized over survivability, and crucially, the modular mission packages were consistently late or failed to fully integrate and meet operational standards. They just couldn't perform the missions they were designed for reliably.
Which is why we now see the plan to return to traditional frigates, but modernized.
Precisely. The Navy plans to purchase up to 20 Constellation-class frigates, and these vessels are notably based on established, proven European designs, specifically the Italian Fremm frigates, which suggests a critical shift back toward proven, robust capability.
We must now turn to the submarines, the Silent Force. The U.S. Navy operates three distinct types, all nuclear-powered: attack, guided missile, and ballistic missile.
The ballistic missile submarines, the Ohio class, are the strategic lifters. They have one sole world-shaping mission, nuclear strategic deterrence, carrying the Trident nuclear missile.
Why is the submarine leg of the nuclear triad considered the most critical and survivable component?
Because of concealment and mobility. A submarine, once it descends into the ocean, is virtually undetectable. It's the ultimate insurance policy. If an enemy launched a preemptive strike against U.S. land or air forces, the SSBNs would remain concealed, guaranteeing a devastating retaliatory strike.
The ultimate deterrent.
The very definition of deterrence. And the tactical versatility is shown by the conversion of some of the Ohio-class SSBNs into SSGNs, or guided missile submarines.
That's a huge story of disarmament meeting tactical innovation.
It is. Four Ohio-class boats were converted. They sacrificed their Trident nuclear missile capability, but in its place, they gained the capacity to carry up to 154 Tomahawk cruise missiles.
Wow.
They can also deploy large numbers of SEALs and other special operations forces, making them incredible conventional strike and special forces platforms.
So the Navy operates 69 submarines in total, including 14 SSBNs and 19 modern Virginia-class attack submarines.
That's right. Finally, let's look skyward at naval aviation. The sources confirm that naval air research began way back in the 1910s.
With the first naval aviator in 1911 and the first carrier, USS Langley, commissioned in 1922.
And as we said, World War II proved that carrier aviation was the future. Today, the primary fighter attack aircraft is the FA-18EF Super Hornet, with the stealthy fifth-generation F-35C having entered service in 2019.
The F-35C, optimized for carrier operations, gives the Navy a true fifth-generation air capability from the sea, which is essential for contested air environments.
And they are already planning the eventual replacement for the Super Hornet through the FAXX program, demonstrating that constant cycle of technological advancement.
And the weapon systems reflect the missile-centric nature of modern warfare. What are the key offensive pieces of ordnance?
Well, the BGM-109 Tomahawk missile remains the primary weapon for long-range precision land strike. For anti-ship engagements, the dedicated missile is the Harpoon, though they're actively developing new generations of anti-ship missiles.
And for defense?
Medium to long-range defense is managed by the Standard Missile 2 and SM-6, all coordinated through Aegis. For short-range, close-in defense, you have the Phalanx CIWS.
The Gatling gun.
Right, firing thousands of rounds per minute. And the RIM-162 Evolved Sea Sparrow missile.
And on the nuclear front, the SSBNs carry the Trident's second SLBM, capable of hitting targets anywhere on Earth.
That's right. And the Navy's other nuclear weapon is the air-deployed B-61 nuclear bomb, a thermonuclear device that can be carried by strike aircraft like the FA-18 and F-35C.
The sheer volume and technological depth of this integrated, layered arsenal are what allow the U.S. to commit to global dominance. Moving from the sophisticated hardware to the intangible assets, the Navy maintains a rich culture and tradition, often defined by its visual symbols. One of the most visible changes in recent years relates to the Naval Jack.
The Naval Jack is the flag flown from the bow of a ship when it's moored or anchored. The standard and current jack is the Union Jack, the small blue flag featuring the 50 stars.
But for almost two decades during the War on Terror, it was famously replaced by a historic emblem.
Indeed. From 2002 to 2019, Secretary of the Navy Gordon R. England directed all U.S. naval ships to fly the first Navy Jack.
The Don't Tread on Me flag.
Exactly. The one with the 13 red and white stripes and a coiled rattlesnake. It was originally adopted to commemorate the first anniversary of 9/11 and stood as a symbol of maritime combat readiness during a time of conflict.
And the return to the Union Jack was a highly symbolic move.
It was. The change back occurred on June 4th, 2019, commemorating the start date of the Battle of Midway in 1942. This battle, as we discussed, fundamentally shifted naval warfare toward the carrier, so the timing underscored a return to the long-term global strategic commitment symbolized by the Union Jack.
The history of the Navy is so intertwined with the history of the country, and that's really evident when you look at the incredibly diverse roster of notable sailors who served.
It's a powerful list, illustrating the kind of leaders the service molds. Six American presidents served in the Navy: JFK, LBJ, Nixon, Ford, George H.W. Bush, and Jimmy Carter.
Jimmy Carter's service is particularly relevant to his later civilian career, isn't it?
Absolutely. Carter served as a nuclear engineering officer working under Admiral Hyman G. Rickover, the father of the nuclear navy. This highly specialized technical background deeply influenced his later policy decisions, particularly his focus on energy.
We also have the foundational officers like John Barry, the first flag officer, and James Lawrence, whose famous last words, "Don't give up the ship," are immortalized in the Naval Academy motto.
And the roster of others is truly surprising in its diversity. We have astronauts like Neil Armstrong and Alan B. Shepard, alongside the pioneering computer scientist and Navy officer Grace Hopper.
Rear Admiral Grace Hopper, who was instrumental in developing the first commercial compiler and popularized the term debugging.
Her entire technical career was built on her naval service.
And the cultural impact is huge. Entertainers like Johnny Carson, Paul Newman, and Jack Lemmon all served. Authors too, Robert Heinlein and Thomas Pynchon, both spent time in the Navy.
It's clear the Navy is a melting pot. And to pull out one small fascinating detail that really shows the human and logistical side of the Navy, the naval post offices.
This sounds incredibly anachronistic now in the age of instant satellite communications.
It is, but it was hugely important. The first U.S. government post offices were established aboard Navy ships during World War I. Before instant messaging, hand-stamped mail was literally the only way crew members at sea could communicate with their families.
And the sources highlight that mail delivery was considered almost as essential to crew morale as food and ammunition.
It was, and this gives rise to valuable historical documentation. It's known as postal history, because nearly every U.S. Navy ship has its own post office and unique postmark. Naval mail provides historians with valuable, concrete evidence.
Details like names, ranks, signatures, and postmarks can confirm the precise dates and locations of ships and crew members during specific operations or battles.
Sometimes, when official records were lost or delayed, it's a fantastic reminder that the organizational mass and technical complexity of the Navy is ultimately built upon the individual experience of the sailor. So what does this all mean? We've traced the USN's journey from a necessary defense against Barbary pirates to a global power broker, defined by that monumental strategic shift from relying on battleships to embracing carrier dominance and nuclear deterrence.
Right. We've covered the complexity of its organization, from the civilian SEETA to the numbered fleets that span the globe, and the highly structured enlisted and officer corps built around specialized warfare qualifications.
And we also detailed its vast arsenal, centered on the nuclear-powered carrier strike groups and the critical integrated defense provided by the Aegis combat system.
The U.S. Navy's primary defining role is maintaining security and deterring conflicts via sustained forward presence. This knowledge is essential for you, the listener, because the organizational complexity, the sheer scale of the equipment, and the massive personnel count are directly tied to U.S. foreign policy execution and global economic stability.
It is the physical means through which the U.S. secures and maintains the current international global order.
It is the operational reality behind global policy.
Which brings us back to that strategic dilemma we noted early on. Given the current Chief of Naval Operations assessment that a fleet of over 500 ships is truly needed to meet global commitments, while the active battle force hovers consistently around 300 vessels, well, this raises an important question for you to consider. If resources consistently fall short of that required fleet size goal, how might the Navy's strategic commitment to sustain forward presence have to fundamentally change?
Mm.
Will the Navy be forced to trade presence in one vital region for readiness in another? Or might they have to shift their strategy altogether to prioritize deterrence capabilities over continuous forward deployment? It's a fascinating dilemma of resources versus commitment for the world's most powerful Navy.
An essential question to ponder as global dynamics continue to shift. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the United States Navy.